The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to our daily news podcast. It's Monday, February the 18th, 2008. I'm Andy Duckworth. Today, the to-ing and fro-ing is over. Northern Rock will be nationalised.
The government has decided to bring forward legislation to bring Northern Rock into a temporary period of public ownership.
The government's reputation's taken a terrible battering. The Tories had an opportunity to establish their credibility but didn't rise to it and have just been making cheap negative points. So, no, there aren't too many winners.
Kosovo goes it alone. MPs there have declared independence from Serbia. Our correspondent in Pristina looks at how the rest of the world is reacting. Also, after months of turmoil, Pakistan finally goes to the polls. But will the elections be free and fair? Plus, why gang culture is growing out of control in our top security jails.
They use all their ingenuity to equip themselves with homemade but utterly lethal weapons inside prison, blades and stabbers as they refer to them.
First, a summary of the day's main news with Sandy Waugh.
The Chancellor, Alistair Darling, is to introduce emergency legislation to nationalise Northern Rock today. The move follows an unsuccessful five-month search for a private buyer. Bids for the stricken bank from Richard Branson's Virgin Consortium and the Northern Rock management team have been rejected as poor value for the taxpayer. The Chancellor's assured customers of Northern Rock their money remains safe. People who leave the armed forces with long-term mental illnesses are not being properly cared for in the NHS, a group of MPs says today. The report follows news of cuts in the defence budget and fears from military chiefs of overstretch. James Arbuthnot, the chairman of the Defence Select Committee, spoke to us earlier.
It is good that the Ministry of Defence has announced there will be priority for veterans for healthcare. The trouble is there is no robust system for identifying who actually is a veteran. So it's quite difficult to work out whether that person should jump the queue. It makes the priority for veterans pretty meaningless.
Pakistan goes to the polls today amid fears of violence and vote rigging. The election was originally scheduled for earlier in the year but was postponed after the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. Government officials maintain it will be free and fair and will mark the transition from military to civilian law. Mohammed Al-Fayed is set to give evidence for the first time today at the inquest of Princess Diana. Mr. Al-Fayed claims the crash, which killed the princess and his son, Dodi, was engineered by British security services. And in football, the draw for the quarterfinals of the FA Cup takes place this afternoon. Manchester United and Chelsea join Liverpool's conquerors Barnsley in the last eight, along with Bristol Rovers of League One. Today's papers are dominated by the nationalising of Northern Rock. The Independent, though, leads with Kosovo's declaration of independence. A core group of European nations will formally recognise its existence as a state today, but the Indy says Kosovo will need all the help it can get. Inside the Times, there's news that GPs will soon be required to inform bosses of what tasks an employee is fit to undertake. This is part of new plans from the Health Secretary to tackle a so-called sick note culture. The Mirror splashes with news that Channel 4 hosts Richard and Judy are in talks to save their chat show following an earlier announcement that they were to quit. And the back pages make grim reading for Liverpool boss Rafa Benitez. His future's on the line after his side's shock FA Cup exit. Goalkeeper David James is pictured in the sun punching the air after his penalty save helped Portsmouth into the quarterfinals in a 1-0 win at Preston. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
The Treasury's announced Northern Rock will be nationalised. Chancellor Alistair Darling says neither of the two private proposals delivered value for money to the taxpayer.
The government has now completed its review of the two detailed proposals on the table, and we've made our choice after considering all proposals. Last autumn, the government stepped in to save Northern Rock to stop its problems spreading to other parts of the banking system.
Emergency legislation will now be rushed through Parliament with a full statement later. In a moment, we'll speak to the Lib Dem Treasury spokesman. But first, business correspondent Philip Inman's here to explain what this means.
Well, it means that we all own a bank now. We're all proud owners of a financial institution. And I think the reason that we are is because, as Alistair Darling set out, Richard Branson was going to make the taxpayer wait too long to get their money back. And the in-house bid team, the executives in Northern Rock who'd got together, they simply couldn't come up with enough money to put into the bank to make it feel secure. That's something that Richard Branson could do, but Richard Branson wasn't prepared to give way on giving the taxpayer a profit out of the bank for what could be many, many years. And I think so between the two of them, they didn't have what it took as far as the government were concerned, so they were left with no option but to take it into public ownership.
Okay, and what does that mean for taxpayers and what does it mean for the shareholders?
Well, it's not entirely clear. I mean, obviously, we own a bank and we're going to run a bank. We're going to run it at arm's length. We're going to let this guy, Ron Sandler, take charge of it. And our understanding is that given that it's the safest bank in Britain now, because it has the government standing behind it, other banks are hopping mad and that they will be making representations to the Treasury. Because why would you go and put your deposits with another bank when you could put it with the safest one in Britain, which is Northern Rock, owned by the government, run by the government? And that seems to be an obvious reaction from the banking community. Now, of course, shareholders have been carved out. They're being told that they'll get next to nothing for their shares. While we don't know what the other banks are going to do, we're pretty sure the shareholders are going to make as much noise as they possibly can. They're going to run to their lawyers, they're going to go to court, and they're going to try and sue the government to say that it's not a fair value for the bank. And I think most outside observers can't see how they've got a case. You know, their bank was bust last summer and it only was able to float on the sea because the government came in with a lifeboat and rescued it.
Okay, Philip, so it's not over yet. Now, let's get a take on what this means politically. Someone who's commented on the Northern Rock saga throughout is the Liberal Democrats' Treasury spokesman, Vince Cable. He joins me on the line now. Vince, are you surprised?
The Liberal Democrats have been arguing from the very outset of this crisis that public ownership, temporary nationalisation was necessary and the only practical way of safeguarding the taxpayers' interest. And the government have now got to the right place. It's taken an awful long time and they've wasted money as well as time. But nonetheless, they are now doing the right thing and we shall certainly support the legislation when it goes through Parliament this week while making our own suggestions about how to introduce necessary safeguards. I mean, for example, one key step, which Alistair Darling hasn't yet mentioned, it's the need for an independent audit of the assets, the loan book of the bank, which we suspect is rather badly decayed. And it certainly needs to be confronted openly in a way that it hasn't been in recent months.
Are there any winners in this?
Not many, no. I mean, unfortunately, there will be quite a lot of pain. I mean, the shareholders, I don't know whether the government proposes to compensate them and how. I mean, we've argued that they should have an option for any future sale, but they can't expect a great deal because the shares are not worth anything without government support. The employees at least have now the prospect of a long-term future for the bank, but there will have to be downsizing, so it will be painful for them. The hedge funds who bought in trying to make a quick killing will now presumably lose money, which I'm not sure too many people will feel too sadly about. The government's reputation's taken a terrible battering. The Tories had an opportunity to establish their credibility but didn't rise to it and have just been making cheap negative points. So, no, there aren't too many winners.
And do you think that the Chancellor's finally managed to kind of draw a line under all of this now?
He's got to the first base of quite a difficult mountain. He's drawn a line under the uncertainty, which is necessary and right. But there are big, you know, practical questions that now need to be faced. There's the compensation issue. There is trying to stop the bank from engaging in imprudent practices. It's been continuing to lend more than the value of people's property. It's been advancing aggressive interest rates for depositors. I mean, that kind of thing is going to have to stop. There's going to have to be a thorough audit of the state of the mortgage book. We don't know how good it is. Then this government-owned bank is going to have the tricky problems of downsizing and jobs involved, running a bank in a period of decline in the property market with repossessions. I mean, all that's going to be very, very tricky. But nonetheless, they are now in the right position, and I'm much happier than if they had sold it off to Branson or the other consortium who would have made a private killing out of this eventually, while the taxpayer was taking all the risk.
OK, Vince Cable, thanks very much. And for more reaction, comments and analysis on this story, go to guardian.co.uk. Also on our website today at guardian.co.uk/media, we look at the Brit Awards bounce ahead of this week's nominations. How much do they affect record sales? If you click on World News along the top, you'll find a piece on Australia's escaping horse. One of racing's top animals down under has done a runner and joined Wild Stallions. Plus, search for Strictly Come Mining. It's a piece on how coal queens are being revived.
O rexit e popullit ton të zgjedhur në mënyrë demokratike.
Kosovo has made an historic declaration of independence from Serbia. Parliament burst into applause as one speaker declared, Kosovo is a republic, an independent, democratic and sovereign state. Its bid is backed by the US and key European allies, but bitterly contested by Serbia and Russia. Our diplomatic editor, Julian Borgia, is in the capital, Pristina. Julian, first of all, what's the mood like there?
Well, in Pristina and most of the Albanian areas, absolute jubilation. There's a 24-hour party going on here in the capital with fireworks, the occasional gunfire being fired into the air, free beer, free cake, and everyone on the streets. And in the Serb areas, in the Serb enclaves, very different picture. The mood is one of depression and resentment and occasional protests.
Now, Julian, this is a place that's been battling to find its identity for many years. The Prime Minister now says this marks the end of the dissolution of the former Yugoslavia.
Well, the West is certainly hoping this is the last chapter. I mean, there have been dark warnings that maybe there's further dissolution to come with perhaps the Bosnian Serb Republic inside Bosnia trying to go its own way in taking Kosovo as an example. But certainly there'll be a lot of opposition in the West and more widely to stop the dissolution and the unraveling from going any further.
Now, some countries are for this move, others are against it. What's the latest reaction?
Well, we're expecting later the majority of European Union foreign ministers will sign a declaration saying, recognizing Kosovo's declaration. Russia has very adamantly restated its position that the declaration is illegal and called on the United Nations to annul it, calling for an emergency meeting of the Security Council to argue the point out.
And I guess this puts the UN Secretary General in a very difficult position.
That's right. With the Security Council split, it's very hard for Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, to know what to do. He has to issue instructions of some kind to his people on the ground to formally hand over to the European Union and to a new international civilian office that's supposed to take over from the UN in a supervisory role. Now, the question is, can he do that without the approval of Security Council? And the opinions on this differ. Russia saying, absolutely, he can't. He can't change the status of the UN on the ground without the approval of the Security Council. The West saying he can and should. So he's in a difficult position. He's going to have to say something, issue some instructions. But it's not clear at this moment what he will say.
And Julian, what's next for Kosovo? Is this a country that can survive on its own?
Well, that's a good question. It's definitely still very much reliant on foreign aid and the remittances of Kosovars working abroad. There's a very open question over whether it is economically viable in the long term. It has unemployment over 40%. There are 30,000 new graduates coming onto the job market each year, and there just aren't the jobs for them. It would need a real economic transformation to make this a viable state. And the Kosovars are hoping that the Declaration of Independence will free up foreign investment and free up the economy, because people will have a long-term vision of it, and that will get the economy kick-started. But it's got a long way to go.
Julian Borgia, thanks very much.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
After weeks of waiting, millions of Pakistanis are going to the polls. Their country's been teetering on a knife edge since President Musharraf declared emergency rule last year. That was then made worse by December's assassination of opposition leader Benazir Bhutto. These national and provincial elections are supposed to be a landmark in the transition to democracy after 8 years of military rule. Declan Walsh is in Lahore for us. Declan, a tense time and already there's been bloodshed.
Saturday evening there was a suicide bombing against an independent candidate who was supporting Benazir Bhutto's Pakistan People's Party. The attack took place in a place called Parachinar near the Afghan border. 47 people dead, over 100 wounded, and an attack that's really underscored the great instability facing Pakistan as it goes into these elections, particularly in northwest frontier province along the Afghan border.
As the polls have already opened, opposition politicians are voicing concerns about vote rigging. Former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif claims Musharraf was bent upon rigging the elections, and former Pakistan cricket captain Imran Khan says that Mr. Musharraf would cling to power any which way.
Well, that's right. That's really the main opposition concern going into this vote. The Sharif's party and Bhutto's party in particular are saying that the government has been engaged in extensive pre-poll rigging over the last number of weeks. They say that they fear that today we're going to see actual direct vote rigging in the form of ballot stuffing, particularly in rural polling stations around the country. That said, they are going ahead with this poll, and they still seem to hold out hope that despite their concerns about rigging, that it will be possible for them to contest this election, to win seats and to wrest power from Musharraf. Of course, the signs that he has given over the last number of months, particularly since the imposition of the state of emergency and the suspension of the constitution early last November, seem to indicate that he is not willing to concede power. And indeed, he said that if the opposition launches protests, as they're threatening to do, once the results are declared, and if those results show that they've been defeated, then that he will not stand for these protests and that they will be very forcefully put down by the security forces in Pakistan. So that's a prospect that really has left people here very tense. They're very worried about where these elections are leading and what the aftermath will bring.
And is there any indication as to which way this is going to go? And what's the influence of Benazir Bhutto's assassination over all of this?
Well, we don't have any fantastically reliable polls, but the ones that have come out consistently indicate that Bhutto's party will get the lion's share of the vote. Some of them say she'll get 35%, others 50%. They say that Nawaz Sharif's party will be in second place and that Musharraf's political vehicle, the Pakistan Muslim League Q, will be a very distant third. The polls seem to indicate that Musharraf's growing unpopularity in the country has been very firmly reflected in the popularity levels of his own party as well. The surge in popularity for Bhutto is to some degree at least being attributed to a sympathy vote since her assassination last December.
I'm Andy Duckworth, and still ahead on this edition of Guardian Daily, as the National Farmers Union holds its 100th conference, we ask, are they more interested in what the government or the supermarkets can do for them? Plus, why some species of sharks could be extinct within our lifetimes.
They're big, but they're not big and scary like the idea that we have of sharks from Jaws, but rather they're really beautiful, absolutely majestic predators.
Hello, I'm Rosie Swash, and I'm taking over from Paul McInnes to bring you the latest Music Weekly. We've got an interview with new Swedish pop star Leaky Lee, reviews of the latest singles from Goldfrapp, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and Cut Off Your Hands. That's all on Guardian Music Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
Some of Britain's most hardened criminals are asking to be put in solitary confinement for their own safety. Segregation units inside high-security prisons used to be full of inmates being punished for breaking the rules or because they were too dangerous to mix with others. They're now seeking protection because of a new influx of rival gang members. Ministers are being warned the problem's getting so bad it's now extremely difficult to find enough Category A accommodation to separate them. The Guardian's Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis, has been investigating.
The latest problem to afflict Britain's jails is, in a sense, an unexpected consequence of the government's much tougher approach to dealing with gun and knife crime with much longer sentences. The net result is that two of the independent monitoring boards, that's the jail watchdogs at Britain's high security prisons, are warning ministers that the inner city gun and gang culture, in terms of convicting members of that culture, rival gangsters, is fueling a new wave of fear and violence within high security prisons. Prisons are now finding it extremely difficult to find separate places for sentenced rival gang members. And these are people who are often in their early 20s serving very long sentences, who have deep allegiances. And the prison watchdogs say, the Intermediary Monitoring Board say, they use all their ingenuity to equip themselves with homemade but utterly lethal weapons inside prison, blades and stabbers as they refer to them, and also often have an easy access to a supply of mobile phones.
So what's the government doing to address the problem?
Well, it seems though it's a problem which is only just emerging. The watchdogs, no doubt the high security prison managers, are saying it's no longer enough just to ask each high security prison to take a certain number of rival gang members. They need to have some national policy of allocation here so that they can separate out people from rival gangs. In the local prisons such as Manchester and Brixton, there's a policy there of it's not normal to separate out rival gang members, even in Category A units, unless there is real intelligence or a specific known threat as to why there might be trouble. Something a bit more sophisticated needs to be put together in order to manage them, and we're not going to see our prisons go the same way as some very violent American jails. It also means that there needs to be much more rigorous searching going on, and the spread of homemade weapons inside high security prisons is a very worrying development for ministers.
And is this creating any problems outside our prisons?
Well, the problem, of course, here is that if they can't break gang and gun culture inside prison amongst convicted prisoners, when they come out, and eventually they will come out, they will only in turn serve to fuel that inner city gun culture and crime culture. It means that the work that goes on in communities to combat gun crime must also perhaps start in much greater earnest inside prisons as well, if that cycle of reoffending is not to be broken.
Next, the National Farmers Union is beginning its 100th conference with a raft of senior politicians from all sides trying to woo members. Some of the issues being discussed include Britain's moral duty to produce more food in order to lighten the load on poorer countries. Tesco's chief executive, Sir Terry Leahy, addresses the conference later, and I've been speaking to Anthony Gibson from the NFU and asked him what he's expecting to hear from the supermarket.
As we understand it, he's going to talk about Tesco's commitment to sourcing more local food, which is very good news indeed, and setting up depots around the country so that they can buy food in regions like the West Country, for example. And that's all good stuff. What we don't think he's going to say is anything about longer-term supply arrangements with livestock farmers, which we desperately need to give people producing beef, cattle, lambs, and pigs some sort of confidence that when they embark on the production process, which in the case of beef cattle takes 3.5 years, at the end of it, they're going to be paid a price that will leave them with a reasonable profit for a decent product.
At your conference, you're also hearing from the Prime Minister, David Cameron, and Nick Clegg are also going to be there. What's more important, government policies or Tesco's policies, supermarkets policies?
Well, that's a very good question. And certainly the balance has changed enormously, even in the last 5 years. And on the output side, the pricing side of the industry, if you like, then it's the market that counts. It's supermarkets and beyond them, consumers. But the government still does have a very important role, particularly in the regulatory agenda, and that has a huge impact on farmers' costs. And the other thing that we're going to be looking for from government is a real commitment to helping farmers maximise the potential of agriculture in this country. There's been a certain amount of lip service to the importance of productive agriculture in a world increasingly threatened by climate change. We're not seeing it, for example, in investment in research and development for agriculture. And we will be saying to the government, look, the farming situation is changing very rapidly. Things have moved on enormously from the last time that you took a serious look at strategy for farming in 2001. Let's sit down together and set out a vision for British farming that fits the world as we find it rather than the world as it was 5 or 6 years ago.
Anthony Gibson from the NFU. And if you're interested, our website has a cow count looking back at farming throughout the decades. Click on guardian.co.uk/ruralaffairs. 9 species of shark are being added to the World Conservation Union's Red List of Endangered Animals. Experts say overfishing and finning are threatening many breeds, particularly the scalloped hammerhead. The Guardian science correspondent Alok Jha's in Boston at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He's been speaking to Julia Baum, who's an oceanographer and member of the World Conservation Union's Shark Specialist Group.
There's several factors that make scalloped hammerhead really susceptible. First of all, it takes a really long time to reach maturity. It doesn't mature until it's 16 years of age. It's caught in a wide variety of fisheries. It's found coastally throughout temperate and tropical waters, so it's taken as bycatch in coastal fisheries that are targeting swordfishes and tunas. It's taken targeted for its fins because its fins are one of the most highly valued fin types on the Asian market. And it's really easy to catch a lot of them if fishermen hit upon them because this is one of the species of sharks that schools. So these travel in really large schools, particularly congregating around islands. And so if fishermen hit upon them, it's pretty easy to wipe out a whole school. When they are schooling, I mean, they're an incredibly beautiful species. And so there's a lot of underwater video of them. I mean, they're absolutely gorgeous. Ecotourism is starting up for these species so that divers can go and see them, particularly in the Galapagos. And I think that that's a really positive thing because it's a way for everyday people to see that these sharks aren't big and, I mean, they're big, but they're not big and scary like the idea that we have of sharks from Jaws, but that rather they're really beautiful, absolutely majestic predators.
As someone who sort of is deeply concerned about the conservation of sharks around the world, and you've worked with them for most of your career, I mean, isn't it a depressing job to have to put them onto things like endangered lists? I mean, how does that feel?
It's a bit of a depressing job to have to move more and more of these species onto IUCN Red List, but it's also a way to flag them and to say, hey, listen up, these species are becoming endangered. We have an opportunity right now to make a big change to if we can implement effective management measures. Right now, because they're getting put on these lists, a lot of resolutions are being passed right now calling for stronger shark management, and what we need to see now is to move beyond those resolutions and actually get fishing curtailed globally if we're going to make a difference and actually save these shark species.
Alok Jha speaking with Julia Baum, and Alok will be presenting a special edition of our Science Weekly podcast from the AAAS Science Conference in Boston. Nice work if you can get it. The team will be discussing the future of cloned food, speaking with the world's leading futurists who believes technology will solve everything from the energy crisis to poverty. Even life on Mars gets a mention. The planet, not the TV show. The web address is coming up in just a moment. But that's it for today's podcast. Tomorrow's edition will be available to download first thing in the morning, ready for your journey to work. The producers are Ian Chambers and Phil Maynard. I'm Andy Duckworth. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.